Welcome to Grails, a podcast by Alton Insights. My name is John Tunger, and this is one of our biggest episodes yet. I am joined by Darren Revell. He first hit it big in his journalism career as the sports business journalist at ESPN. He then did a stint at CNBC, then back to ESPN, and now he currently works at the Action Network as a sports business reporter and senior executive producer. But when it comes to why that applies to this podcast, it's because he really is one of the world's most renowned collectors of memorabilia, NFTs. He has a really out there collection of some unique items like signed checks, game tickets, right? That's something that he's been buying for a long time. We'll even talk about how he has multiple items signed by Martin Luther King. And lastly, near the end of the episode, he'll give his hot take on that video game scandal that we addressed last week. So a ton of great insight in this interview with Darren Revell. Let's get started.
I got a job at ESPN that I helped create in 2000 out of school at a Northwestern. Covering the business side of sports, there was no one really doing it nationally. And I thought it was such a big business that it needed to have some coverage. And ESPN agreed, or at least gave me a shot. It was a good time to give a young kid a shot. And worked there for 6 years. And then I went from being the geek at the sports network to the cool guy at the business network. Went to CNBC, basically did the same thing. I got to cover two Olympics, fortunately, in Beijing and Vancouver in 08 and 10. Went back to ESPN after kicking their butt for a while and, you know, trying to establish myself as the best-in-class business reporter. And then fast forward to November 2018, I'm sitting in here in New Jersey and I'm just thinking, wow, this is the most telegraphed thing ever with betting. And here I am sitting in New Jersey and going between New York and New Jersey and seeing the buses and just realizing that this is a moment in time that I have a chance to see into the future, and it's actually not that hard. So I asked them to let me out of my contract and went to the Action Network. It's been a great 3 years. We sold ourselves to a Danish company, Better Collective, and still at the Action Network. And, you know, at the same time, I have a food and beverage VC called Tastemaker Capital. We've invested in some companies. I advise and have invested in other companies, at least 10 companies. And so it's a busy life for me. In the fractional space, I advise Rally, help them find great stuff, help them with comps, nice. Talk to them every week about things. Also am a part owner and an advisor in Alt.
So with all that context just built in there, what are some assets that you're looking into the future and are like, hey, guys, this is, how are you not looking at this yet?
Yeah, listen, I'm not as concerned with liquidity as other people are, I think, because I can help tell stories. So if there are things with stories, I certainly love to do that. I've been collecting checks for 5 years, just felt there was an arbitrage opportunity. Most people just look at checks. And before I came in, I mean, the only check collectors I had known were people who just felt more comfortable with the signature because who's going to forge a check. But with great story, all of mine have great stories and there's added value there. I think tickets are going to be a big thing. I've invested. I have about 250 graded tickets from PSA. I think that's going to be that'll be big. I think right now there's probably only about 5,000 ticket collectors. I think that will grow. I've invested a bunch into Buffett and Gates. Jobs has never really been in my pay grade and certainly not now. There are these little niches that I think are discoverable and I have fun finding them. I think a lot of people, especially because they're trained in the card world, they're comfortable with comps, and in the fractional space and at the, you know, larger level, you have to be comfortable with not having exact comps and still making a move. I recently bought what I think is the best Walt Disney signature that exists in the world, and you look at comps right now and it would suggest $5,000-$6,000 for a good Walt Disney signature, you have to be comfortable saying, I'm willing to pay double or triple for the best of the best, and not necessarily finding a comp. It gets a little hairy with fractional companies because sometimes they have a responsibility to the SEC to show comps so that they're not upwardly marking things to start. But that doesn't mean that things are off the table.
What is your like collector to investor percentage, right? So when you're buying this Walt Disney thing, is that more in the hopes that, hey, sometime in the future, I'm selling it?
There's nothing that I collect that I don't think has a future of selling. And I believe that almost everything I buy is the cheapest the day I buy it.
Wow. Wow. I mean, I guess that's the hope, right? That for everyone who's buying things off of eBay or whatever, but I'm so curious, like when you're just sitting in your, is this just you sitting at your desk right here, looking up at the ceiling going like, man, okay, investment thesis, what are people not thinking about? Like, what is your whole process like? Especially because you have an inside look at a lot of this.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is based on nostalgia. You look at COVID and what's kind of happened. And one of the reasons why, cards popped and all these things popped is not only the alt asset belief that, you know, you're not getting anything from your bank, but I think it's also the dopamine of, hey, we need something to give ourselves because we don't have normal human interaction. So, for me, I think I'm a nostalgician in a way, and it's not that I think I'm the smartest guy ever, but I do think that I gravitate to nostalgia as an 80s kid. In that way, it comes back, naturally. When you think about video games, to me, that made a whole lot of sense. There's something that's handheld, that's graded, that's standardized. I think VHS tapes make a whole lot of sense. I think that's next. And then you'd kind of just do the work like, okay, why does a VHS tape make sense? Well, because posters are not going to be graded. They're too big. This is a mini poster on a piece of technology that no longer exists. Yeah. Then they're graded and they're standardized and it makes a lot of sense. One of the things that I've learned is about size and people are comfortable holding something in their hand, and there are massive discounts for things that are larger.
Especially when you compare that to like paintings, right? Like people would say like, but paintings, you hang them on their wall, they're big, but they drive big prices. But you're saying for the collectibles, it almost goes in the opposite direction.
And if you look at, I think that's really what's been the negative on jerseys. It's almost like you have to hang them. I think fractional actually helps in that standpoint. The idea that cards can be in vaults and stuff like that, I think that helped fractionalize things a lot because it made people aware that, hey, I could even not have the card and I can still invest. And I think it's been kind of special what fractionalization has done. I also like the things that Rally has done as far as like giving you a little piece of something, the Kobe floor or whatever.
Right.
And there's real value. I do think that we have to get to a point of everyday trading for it to be more real and not just random trading windows. But I think it's been really exciting for people to be able to get a piece.
And we're starting to see everyday trading on some platforms, which has made some volatile swings. Do you think that's right around the corner? I mean, why do you think that, like, is the market even ready for that?
Listen, when I was at CNBC and I was on the air, I couldn't trade anything, nor could anyone in my immediate family. I basically just had to have mutual funds. I couldn't do anything day to day. And then there was a second class where a producer could trade something, but it would only be at a 30-day period that CNBC told you a day before. It's not an efficient market if you're just telling people when the trading windows are. You need to have market efficiency, which means that it has to be 24/7 or at least, 5 days a week. It has to be reflective of what the marketplace is, what the feeling is, what the sentiment is. And so it's got to get there.
Do you think that the fractional audience is there? Like if say people were to open all the platforms, were to say, hey, we're here right now, open everyday trading, or would the volatile swings be too much?
They would get used to it because they'd have to. I think a lot of people, when they come out of it, they say, hey, why is it why is the next trading window in 2 months? Why can't I, you know, this Steve Jobs thing, this Steve Jobs Apple One computer sold and we have an Apple One computer. I bought a piece of it. Why do I have to wait a month to trade it? So I think, you know, there are going to be some people who say, I don't really, you know, I didn't buy this for it to be a stock every day and I can't keep up with it. But I think there will be a bunch of people who will say that this is a good thing.
Yeah. So I want to even go back to what you were saying about like looking in the future and saying, this is so telegraphed, so obvious. I agree. The same thing with sports betting now looks like that's happening with sports cards, memorabilia and all of that. Right. You can even follow the media dollars of like, it was so obvious when DraftKings was pumping money onto ads at ESPN and all this stuff that like, it'll get a larger market adoption. Do you think that that same large market adoption could happen with sports cards, memorabilia, these all assets? Because the media dollars, you know, Barstool Sports is making content, you guys making content about it, to where it almost seems like that's where the tide is going.
Yeah, listen, the media dollars into this is great. I mean, you just look at what eBay has to spend, what Golden has to spend, what Whatnot has to spend. I mean, you raise $50 million, you got it. You got to spend, you got to activate. It's a major competition. And it's been amazing to see the money that is raised, the companies bought. Just look at Blackstone and CGC and obviously, you know, the Chernin Group and Nat and PSA and Golden. It's really been amazing to see where it's at. I think that you still have to worry about who's pushing what and what the narrative is. I mean, that's what I have to think about when I do make my individual decisions. I'm totally out of cards, for example. And that's that a lot of that has to do with that. I just don't enjoy them. Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a guy at Ultimate Pastime on Instagram, Mark, in California. And, you know, his quote is buy what you like. And it sounds so simple, but a lot of people don't do that. You know, I obviously have things in vaults and things in other places, and there's some things that I bring to my house, like, because I have to see them. And I really enjoy it. So I think that, we're living in this confusing time. I'm not so sure people love CryptoPunks. I think they love the money associated with it. and so I think buying what you like is more important than ever before. And is an important message to people, because the issue is that why doesn't something completely crash when the market, you know, turns? And the reason is because people like a piece of it and they still want to hold on to it. It's why the Michael Jordan rookie in the 10 only goes down to 250,000, because at some point people are just going to hold on. But if there's assets that are just pumped up and there's not enjoyment to it, that has a chance of a greater crash. So I'm 43. I've done this market. I've done the card crash. You know, I was out in 92 and didn't come back in for a long time. I've been in memorabilia, you know, since I was a kid and never got out. And, you know, so I just caution people to understand why you put something in. Don't do it because you're following. Don't do it because someone said that they were doing it. Make your own decisions, make your own calls, and come up with your own thesis. If you have to write it down, why do you think this will go? Don't be afraid to go all in on certain things. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you should go all in your whole collection. You should be diversified.
Yeah, I've heard you say if something's so obvious, you should probably question it. And there's some of that kind of stuff right now, right? Especially with NFTs in that world. If something's so obvious, if it seems so easy, you should probably question it.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a really confusing world, especially for younger people, because, you know, they're thinking about the pumping up of crypto and the pumping up of everything else. And, you know, as a journalist, I really worry about that. And I always have, you know, people say, hey, oh, you've been pumping up tickets. It's like, no, I really enjoy tickets. I've only sold one of my 250, you know, so it's not, there's negative connotations all of a sudden with talking up something. But I think, you know, people really have to be careful and try to analyze what the market is. I mean, again, these populations, tickets come down to, and I said, it's hard to compare, you know, it's hard to always get comps, but look at, you know, 17,000 Zion Williamson Prism 10s. I mean, come on, get out of here, yeah. You know, and then you have, you know, tickets, some tickets that have 10 to 12 of them. The argument against that is there's not enough liquidity for me, but I think overall in the ticket business, there is liquidity. So, you know, I just think now we are fortunate to see all these numbers, and you have to do the math. You have to do the work.
I think for people that especially listen to this podcast, we've actually talked about tickets quite a bit. We've had people on the show. And so with that line, like if something's so obvious, even question it. I think what's hard is for people who are really, really into this kind of stuff, we look at it, we're like, oh man, well maybe now the opportunity's passed. Maybe we missed it. How do we gauge like what inning a trend is in?
That's a tough one. And people always say, hey, we're in the first inning. And it's like, that bothers me. I don't think we need to say that. You know, I don't think we need to call what inning it's in. I think that, you know, I think it's very important to have a database of all your investments. I think it's very important to ask people what they think. So when people said to me, why are you going to the National? Why did you spend $1,200 a table if you don't really intend to sell anything? And the answer was, I intended to see what people thought. I had pumped well north of $100,000 into tickets, and I wanted to see if people who had never seen them before thought as much as I did of them. And they did. They did. Now, you know, you can't surround yourself with yes people. You cannot filter data. I do think that it made me look at the tickets that are okay. The tickets that are sensational, and people are like, wow. The craziest insight that I learned at National was how much people love Walt Disney's signature. I had a check, Walt Disney paying his 1962 taxes, that I priced too high to sell. And people were seriously looking at it. And, you know, from that, I then invested more into Disney signatures. So I think people keep their theories or just show their collections, but they don't openly ask people, what do you think about this? And that's true in business in general. You know, when someone buys a franchise, they actually don't go to the franchise owner who lost their business, which is, by the way, at the back of every franchise disclosure document. Anyone who's ever failed has to be listed. Do they go to the people that fail? No. They go to the most successful person who has the greatest shop in town. So that's human condition. And, you know, I've learned over time that, you know, you have to have a small group of 5 to 10 friends who, before you buy something big, you ask, who are smart. And then you have to try to talk about your collection to other people. I'm not going to say what it is. This is a hell of a tease. But I had a piece in my collection that I spent a lot of money on that I'm now uncomfortable having given how people reacted to it. And wow. I'm going to get rid of it.
Uncomfortable, so, because it's a hot topic item?
I can't really go into it more, but it's like, it's enough of a topic that I don't feel like with my name, I can have it anymore. So
yeah,
it's not something ridiculous or scandalous. But it's just something that my group of people have kind of said, like, you know, you should probably get rid of it.
Your name, when you talk about assets, this is just getting bigger and bigger of a subject that's talked about in the hobby and fractional marketplaces, all this. We had Eric Nierman on the podcast last week, who's kind of in the hot seat for some of the video game stuff. And he's very clear. He's like, I intend to make money off of these assets, and I just talk about what I'm invested in. There's nothing wrong with that. Right. And so he gave a good statement talking about that.
Yeah, and he says he's not a journalist. So he doesn't have the same responsibility that I have. We've had a talk over this. I think it's general nature to pump up the business that you're in. I intend to make money off my collection. I can't tell you any timeline. I can't tell you when I'm selling it. There are things that I think are, again, the cheapest when I bought it. There are things that I have a very hard, that I will have a very hard time selling when it comes to the point. I have written down in some cases on the high end items when those selling points are. You know, for example, 2023, I'm probably going to sell my entire Martin Luther King collection. It'll be the 60th anniversary of I Have a Dream.
Wow.
Together with other people, you know, I'm $300,000-$400,000 deep in that, in amazing pieces. You know, so I do have timelines on things.
Wow.
But it's hard. I'm in a different boat because, first of all, for Eric, it's going to be extremely, he does love it as well, no matter how much he says. And it's always hard to time something. And, I'm not as worried as on timing things perfectly because there's a value to me telling a story. I recently bought a incredible poster from RR Auction, which is one of the first times that the FBI or anyone used serial numbers to track of dollars or of money to track down who committed a crime. And so the poster is just completely ridiculous of when the $50,000 in ransom money was given to the person who kidnapped Charles Lindbergh's baby, they distributed to banks a poster that had every single serial number of all those bills.
Wow.
And it's this amazing poster. And
he's holding up the poster right now, and it's this thing's epic.
And you know, so it's coming up on the day that they caught the guy. Because he used one of the $10 bills at a gas station. Eventually it got to a bank, and then the bank traced it back to his license plate number, which was written on the bill somehow because the person in the gas station thought that he was acting suspicious.
Wow.
And that's how they caught the guy who killed the Lindbergh baby. And, you know, for me, the poster was $800. It's a piece of art. And I'm going to use it as a piece of art, but I'm going to tell that story on September 16th or whenever the anniversary of him getting caught is. And that's worth $800 to me. So I have things that I amortize the cost of what I buy it for by the stories I tell. So right. It's possible that when I buy something, even for thousands and thousands of dollars, if I've told the story four times and people associate it with my brand,
Content.
That's something Darren Revelle would have. That's something. Then actually the cost of it becomes zero.
That is the best justification for your CPA ever when it comes to buying right? all these big assets.
Right? I mean, some people will say that's bullshit, but like, you know, what is the cost of, you know, when someone says on Twitter, that's something Darren Revelle would say, or that's something Darren Revelle would own. How much does that cost you? And what does that stand for? I've amortized the story, and it makes sense to me.
Wow. Yeah. And so much of this, and I don't even want to hit on the whole thing too much, but of just this idea of where these kind of assets intersect with people talking about assets like you are right here. And I even think from a higher level, when you look at like the Elon Musks of the business world and, you know, Gary V talking about whatever, these kind of assets, right? Like this is just such a messy gray area. Do you think that this will be something that's kind of hit on harder?
It concerns me. You know, Gary is now the most influential person in this area. And I know he takes his responsibility seriously because he does talk more and more about, you know, X is going to be garbage. 99% of this is going to be garbage. But guess what? His V Friends is one of the best returning NFTs. That being said, sometimes I wonder why he talks so much about it. I think sometimes maybe it's too much. He's made a tremendous amount of money. I would never want that responsibility to tell I don't tell anyone to go buy anything.
Right.
I just don't want to deal with that something didn't return. I don't tell anyone to go buy tickets. I tell people why I think tickets are cool and why I think tickets make sense. And yeah. If that makes sense to you, that's good. If it doesn't, fine.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
That's how I live with myself, and I'm never I'm never telling friends, you know, what to do, or I just don't want that responsibility.
So when it comes to things that make sense, football season is right around the corner. What players are you looking at? I know like Action Network, right? It starts with sports betting. Now you guys are in all this other stuff, but when you like players, what situations make sense to you where you're like, man, I'm excited to.
Yeah, I actually don't play players, but I do play items. You know, I think, you know, if you look at, you know, Tiger Woods, for example, I'm not doing football, but you know, I'm looking at, what incredible items are there to buy. And so I could buy a Tom Brady, and if Tom's doing well, that's great, but the item has to have some sort of story. And I think for fractional ownership, you know, for fractional companies, I think it's going to be more and more important to tell the story. The story has the value. And getting unique pieces are important. I recently purchased what might be the only piece of paper signed by Martin Luther King and Jackie Robinson.
Wow.
And so, you know, when I'm thinking about whether to pay for this piece, which is just mind blowing, once you do the research and you know, the story is what creates the value. So one, I just told you that it might be the only piece of paper signed by Jackie Robinson and Martin Luther King. Now I'm going to tell you that Martin Luther King and Jackie Robinson are obviously inextricably linked by the fact that they are, you know, the two most important, arguably, African-American pioneers. Then I'm going to tell you that they're also linked by August 28th, Jackie Robinson told by Branch Rickey in 1945 on August 28th that he's going to be the player that Branch Rickey is going to use to break the color barrier.
Wow.
August 28th, 1963 is the I Have a Dream speech. Then I tell you that paper that I bought is from a Back Our Brothers campaign, which is a civil disobedience fundraiser, a $100 plate dinner in New York. And Jackie was there. And Martin Luther King was there. And that's the day that Martin Luther King said, if this doesn't get better, we are going to march on Washington, which leads to the Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech. Right. Wow. So you build this. It's for me, it's all about building stories around an item. And so I don't think of individual players and how to invest in them. If the item makes sense, if the story makes sense, if it's unique, that's how I think of things.
Right. It makes and ties with why you're not buying cards either, unless the picture of the card was some unique moment in the history of the game or something like that. You'd stay away.
Right.
Lastly here, I want to, and I didn't prep you for this question, so you don't have to answer it, but I would love to get your take on some of the video game drama that's been going on with WADA games and heritage auctions. And I know that documentary came out, and actually, according to the guy posted on Twitter that he was doing another series today, so I haven't even seen what that side of the content is. What's your take on the messiness there?
As someone who got into the video game thing naturally, and I think it's a natural thing, I think the idea that this is completely pumped up by insiders is a whole lot of, excuse my language, bullshit. Hmm. And I also think that there's a lot of unchecked inaccuracies that, if I were to try to publish that, my editors at the Action Network would say, well, you know, what's your evidence here? You need two sources. You need this and that. And I think a lot of it, from what I know, would fail the test of real journalism. So to accept everything that has been put on that and has been put on the other guy, Seth's blog, as fact, I think is insane. Sure. There are always, in the beginning of a lot of markets, insiders trading for it to be valuable. Is it opportunist? Yes. Is it criminal? No. And to portray it as criminal to me is idiotic. So to take, and believe me, I purchased $10,000 in video games. This is a very small part of my collection. I have no skin in this game. Mm-hmm. But I do have a skin in the game as a journalist who covers memorabilia, and maybe the biggest guy from a national perspective who happens to cover memorabilia. And that's what bothers me here. I don't think the journalism is top notch here. And I think the idea that this video game hype was created by insiders for them to cash out is garbage.
There we have it from Darren Revelle. Do you mind if I share that on social, or is that okay?
You can share. You can share anything that I say.
Okay, I just want to make sure. Yeah. Anything else that you want to talk about for the people? We got a crowd full of fractional investors here.
I would say that when there are things that are fractionally out there, don't be scared to push the chips in. Don't think you can only invest 4 or 5 shares. You know, I mean, when I saw Rally's Apple One computer, I bought the max 1%. So don't play just because you can. I mean, if you think that there's something behind the, you don't need to own 10 items. If you love one, go for it. That's what's so great about this opportunity. So that's kind of my advice there.
For the lawyers in the back, a quick disclaimer. You understand that by listening to this podcast, you are not receiving financial advice. No content published here constitutes a recommendation that any particular security, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any specific person. You alone are solely responsible for determining whether an investment, security, or strategy, or any other product or service is appropriate or suitable for you based on your investment objectives and personal financial situation. Please speak with a financial advisor to understand if the risks inherent in trading are appropriate for you. Trade at your own risk. Bum, bum, bum.